everyone. You're listening to Pharmacy Focus Oncology Edition, where we bring you the latest trends in the oncology pharmacy space. I'm Alex Gerlach, and today's episode is another takeover led by pharmacy experts focusing on an evolving area in hematologic malignancies. That would be the role of CAR T-cell therapy in acute lymphoblastic leukemia, with a closer look at obecabtagene autoleucel, or obe-cel. Our guests will walk us through the current treatment landscape for ALL, where gaps remain with traditional approaches, and how newer cellular therapies are reshaping care. They'll dig into the mechanism of action behind obe-cel, the clinical trial data supporting its use, and, importantly, what pharmacists need to know about toxicity monitoring, adverse event management, and practical considerations in clinical practice. So, without further ado, I'm happy to pass it over to our pharmacy experts.
Hi, everyone, and thanks for joining us today. We will be discussing obecabtagene autoleucel, or obe-cel as I will refer to it. We'll be talking about how the treatments for acute lymphoblastic leukemia have evolved over time and focus particularly on growing role of CAR T-cell therapy like obe-cel. Before we get started with our discussion, I would like to introduce myself and then let the rest of our panel introduce themselves as well before we get started. My name is Tatiana Gergic. I am an stem cell transplant and cell therapy pharmacy specialist at UNC Medical Center. And to kick us off, I would let our other panelists go ahead and introduce themselves as well.
My name is Jacqueline Del Pena, and I'm a clinical pharmacy specialist at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, and I primarily focus in the adult cell therapy service space.
Hey everyone, I'm Katie Cash. I'm a stem cell transplant and cell therapy pharmacist at Duke University Hospital.
And hi, I'm Rebecca Gonzalez. I'm a clinical pharmacist specialist in BMT and cellular therapy at Moffitt Cancer Center.
Thank you so much for the introductions. To get us kicked off, let's set the stage by discussing what does current treatment landscape look like for acute lymphoblastic leukemia, and what are our current treatment options?
So I could get started on this one. So I'd say approximately 3% of all new cancer diagnosis is acute lymphoblastic leukemia. We do see a high incidence observed in younger adults or children, but we're also seeing an increased incidence of ALL within the elderly population, so older than 65 years old. Most of these patients do have B-cell ALL, and we'll primarily focus on that. In terms of traditional treatment approaches, so I think about it in phases, we have remission induction, followed by consolidation, and then we also see long-term maintenance after that. CNS prophylaxis with IT chemotherapy is also given throughout treatment. And for our younger adults, or really adults with great performance status, we do prefer to administer a pediatric-inspired regimen. Some of our newer treatment options as well include BiTE therapies or bispecific therapies with blinatumomab for consolidation or even relapse, and that could lead to even deeper remissions or MRD negative complete remission or CRs. Tyrosine kinase inhibitors have also revolutionized treatment landscape, specifically for pH positive ALL, historically known to be a high risk subtype prior to the TKI approval. And Katie, I don't know if you have anything else you wanted to add to that as well.
No, I mean, I think, you know, at the end of the day, stem cell transplant, which is our bread and butter, is really kind of historically been our only curative option. There are a lot of downsides to stem cell transplant, of course, especially in this space where, you know, ideal conditioning chemo can consist of, you know, high-dose TBI. And now that we're in the PTCy era of GVHD prevention, combining PTCy and TBI, we're seeing higher rates of transplant-related mortality in this space as well. And so it's nice to have, you know, additional options that induce a durable remission like obe-cel.
I think one of the really fascinating things about ALL is the five-year survival rate is more than 70%. And really, this kind of highlights the importance of immunotherapy, which kind of established in 2014. And since then, we've seen the introduction of antibody drug conjugates like inotuzumab and the integration of actually three CAR T products first being tisa-cel in 2017, brexucel in 2021, and now we have obe-cel, which is FDA approved in 2024. So I think this is a very exciting time for ALL. And as Katie mentioned, historically transplant has been kind of our gold standard for cure. And so there, this is really kind of transforming. Even, every year some new therapy comes out. So it's a very exciting time in this realm. And I know for pediatrics as well.
Thank you so much for the brief overview of how things have evolved. In your experience, what are some of the biggest challenges that patients with ALL tend to face, both in terms of their clinical outcomes, but also their quality of life?
I mean, from a clinical standpoint, at least, even after our early, CD19 directed CAR T therapies in this space, 40 to 50% of patients are still going to relapse. And, what comes next? If you've already had a transplant and you relapse and you still have 40 to 50, 60% relapse rates after CD19 directed CAR T therapy, we need more options. We need options with a more durable response, with better toxicity profiles. And I think that's where obe-cel kind of came on the scene. What I think is interesting and where we struggle is I feel as if we're in a Blincyto era for ALL. And so for patients who have seen CD19 directed CAR or Blincyto in the past, what's the role then for CD19 CAR T cell therapy? And how do patients perform if they've seen prior Blincyto? So I think as Blincyto use continues to grow, it'll be really interesting to see how and when these CAR T cell therapies are used.
I think you bring up a really good point with Blincyto, because I have seen in terms of trials, seeing that earlier in the treatment algorithm as opposed to when it first came out. So I totally agree with you.
I think something really, for me, that I'm looking forward to is a clinical trial called CARCURE that's actually looking at risk-adapted approaches to kind of really find those patients that A, are very high risk for these post-CAR relapses, and B, for those patients that potentially may not even need to go to transplant and remain on long-term immunosuppressive therapy and have some of those post-transplant complications. So I think, as evolution of our hematologic malignancy treatment, really looking at these like risk adapted approaches have kind of come as a mainstream thing across all hematologic malignancies. So I think this is something really exciting, especially for our AYA patients that, potentially maybe they don't even need to go to transplant or have a consolidative transplant, that potentially even just CAR would be cure or remain long-term cure for them in and of itself.
And those are some great points, especially as we all know with transplant, graft versus host disease is still one of the major complications and can be quite devastating, especially in chronic setting for many of the patients. So that directly also relates with the quality of life if we can give them a treatment option that does not have graft versus host disease as one of the potential complications. Moving into sort of the new era of therapy with the CAR T cell therapy, and before we get deeper into discussion on obe-cel, do you guys mind commenting sort of what is the role of CAR T in ALL and how does it compare in terms of response rates, especially in those relapsed and refractory settings where traditional salvage chemotherapy has not had a great success rate in terms of achieving remissions.
Well, I think this opens up a whole new treatment space for those that are chemo resistant, heavily treated, patients with high risk disease, so they relapse earlier on, patients that may not be transplant eligible, but eligible to get CAR T, or patients that are transplant eligible, and that's something that they're thinking about going into as part of their treatment plan. This could be a bridge to that. So CAR T in ALL has really opened up a lot of treatment options now.
Yeah, I completely agree with you, Jackie. I think we've seen it in a couple spaces. I think we've historically primarily used it in patients who have relapsed post first transplant. And we've used it kind of as a final therapy, but we've also used it, as Jackie mentioned, as a bridge to a second transplant. So we've had patients who've had a transplant relapse. Maybe they get inotuzumab, and we're trying to put some space in between inotuzumab and second transplant, trying to get them into a little bit of a deeper remission before second transplant. And so we'll use CAR T almost as a bridge to that second transplant. So I'd say those are the two most common places that, at least here at Duke, I've seen CAR T cell therapy in this space.
And I totally agree. Right now it's kind of that relapse refractory setting. I know there are several kind of trials with existing CAR platforms, potentially for patients just with MRD positivity and not, complete relapse refractory disease. And sure, certainly we've seen that in the myeloma space, kind of integrating CAR T earlier on really adds more bang for your buck, especially with these more highly cost therapies. I think it is important to kind of touch on kind of the three different products, kind of the age ranges are a little bit different. And I know all of us kind of practice in the adult space, but for those that are not as familiar, we have tisa-cel and typically this was in a pediatric and AYA space with the median age being 11. So a lot of adult centers typically beforehand, unfortunately, if the patient was older than 25, before the introduction of brexucab actually did not have CAR T as an option. So really brexucab for those patients who are greater than 25 years of age really kind of transformed how we treat our AYA or older AYA patients. So brexucab was studied in ZUMA-3 and the median age was around 40. So I think that's very realistic of kind of the real world. And as Jackie had mentioned, kind of the we're seeing higher incidence of ALL in our older population. And good no news is in ZUMA-3, they treated up to a patient's 84 years of age. And then in 2024, with integration of obe-cel, that was in patients who were adults. And the median age again was around 50, with like over 20% of them actually being greater than 65, which is really, at least, for obe-cel, kind of a highlight here and being able to treat those more comorbid elderly frail patients with CAR T and giving them the opportunity for potential cure or deep remission.
It sounds we have potentially a better option for relapse refractory disease, and then potentially a different side effect profile, especially which opens up opportunity for some of our older patients and also patients with comorbidities. As we start integrating CAR T therapy as in treatment paradigm more and more, what are some of the unique logistical and even operational challenges that folks should be familiar with as they are trying to take care of patients receiving these CAR T therapies, especially now when REMS has been updated for a shorter interval of 14 days being monitored, patients required to be monitored at the actual treatment center. Any kind of words of wisdom or just logistical or operational challenges that folks should be familiar with?
So I think with the removal of REMS, this really offers a lot of opportunity to potentially treat these patients in the outpatient setting, which really makes obe-cel kind of an ideal product to move into the outpatient space. Similar to other CAR T products and other CD19 products, CRS and neurotoxicity are probably the most common complications that patients can encounter. With the introduction of obe-cel, it does have a unique structure that's a little bit different than our tisa-cel and brexucab. It is very similar to tisa-cel in its co-stimulatory domain, which is 4-1BB, that's associated with kind of that reduction in early expansion and kind of reduction in overall severe toxicities. But it also has another unique antigen binding domain that does offer some reductions in that severe onset of toxicities. So it actually has a lower affinity binding, which kind of reduces the overall toxicity that we see or that we know for this product. I think this is certainly a unique time in that, we have better management strategies. We have early recognition. And I think a lot of centers really have integrated kind of risk adapted approaches and early administration of anti-cytokine therapies or corticosteroids to kind of mitigate some of those really high grade three or higher toxicities. So I know, here at Moffitt, we really try to do early intervention with anti-cytokine therapy when possible in hopes of kind of delaying those grade three or higher toxicities. And anecdotally, it really looks like that has really improved overall outcomes for our patients. So I don't know, Katie, and Jacqueline, if you guys have also kind of seen that from like the ALL perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. Here at Duke, we've used Tecartus primarily for our adult patients, of course, in the past, and we do see those high rates of grade three or four CRS and ICANS. And so it's our standard to admit those patients for the cell infusion and for the first 14 days after cell infusion. So you're committing them to a 2-week inpatient stay. And we've done a small handful of obe-cels already. And while we did our first few inpatient, we haven't seen anything above a grade one CRS. And we've had a patient have no CRS and ICANS. And so I think, moving forward, we'll definitely be looking to move this into the outpatient space since our first few patients did so well. And it's just, I think, a testament to the science. And I think it's just, I love to just nerd out over the mechanism of things like this because it's so cool that we can just change one small portion of the CAR construct and it have such incredible, make such incredible advancements for our patients.
Yeah, our centers are the same here at MSK. Initially with obe-cel, we did treat it inpatient regardless of high or low burden of disease, but we've actually now transitioned to the outpatient space, and we've done that now in practice to administer obe-cel outpatient, but strictly for good performance status patients and a low burden of disease.
Jackie, do you see similar rates of CRS to what Katie mentioned? It sounds like just a grade one CRS for most of those folks.
Yes, mostly grade one. And like Rebecca said, early intervention with anti-cytokine therapy is our typical go-to. I know some of the package inserts with CAR T have said persistent fever for 3 days and maybe considered TOCI at that point. We don't typically let our patients fever for three days or more prior to giving anti-cytokine treatment.
What are some of the clinical trial data that are published currently that support use of obe-cel, either just in terms of safety of efficacy of obe-cel itself or in comparison to some of the other products like brexucel in the same space?
I can kind of introduce kind of the background for the different clinical trials. So obe-cel was FDA approved based off of the FELIX trial. And as I mentioned earlier, kind of older patients, especially 20% around 65 years or older, similar to ZUMA-3, which is brexucel, and ELIANA, which is tisa-cel, patients did undergo prior allogeneic transplant, so kind of that relapse space. All three clinical trials did have patients who were PH positive. As we kind of talked about the integration of into the treatment algorithm, for those patients in the FELIX trial, 35% of patients actually had prior blinatumomab exposure. And I think another important detail beyond just tumor burden is the presence of extramedullary disease, which, kind of across all hematologic malignancies, this is certainly kind of a poor prognosis and horrible risk factor for treatment responses. And in the FELIX trial, approximately 20% of patients actually had extramedullary disease. I think one other important aspect that we didn't get to touch on is kind of the overall, in addition to kind of the structure, is the actual administration of the product itself is kind of really unique. It does offer kind of a risk-adapted approach based on tumor burden. So this is something very different than tisa-cel and brexucel, where patients just received a standard cell dose. During the FELIX trial, patients were actually risk stratified based on their total blast count. So for those that actually had a high blast count, so more than 20%, actually received a lower cell dose of 10 million cells, whereas those with a low tumor burden, so less than or equal to 20%, actually had a cell dose of 100 million cells. And so this product actually kind of risk stratifies based on your existing tumor burden. And then subsequently, and patients can receive another dose. So we usually say day one is like the day the initial cell dose, and then day 10 being the second cell dose. If a patient doesn't have CRS grade two or higher, or any presence of ICANS, they can actually receive the subsequent cell dose, which will either be 310 or 400 to kind of complete a total of 410 million cells. So I think that's something also very unique and allows us to kind of prep the patient for that second cell dose and also kind of allows for that outpatient administration and really those low risk of overall toxicity. So I'll take it over to Katie and Jacqueline if they want to touch base on that kind of overall outcomes for obe-cel.
Yeah, outcomes look pretty promising. So in the overall population, there were a few cohorts, but in kind of the overall population, anyone who received at least one infusion of obe-cel, the overall response rate, so CR or CRI, was 78%, which seems pretty on par with both Brexucil and Tisocel. Medium duration of response, though, seems a bit longer, 21.2 months, likely owing to, as we talked about, that change in the CAR construct that leads to a longer persistence of those CAR cells. Median event-free survival was 12 months, estimated 12-month event-free survival 50%, 12-month overall survival 62%, with a 31% of patients having relapsed at the data cutoff date. From a toxicity standpoint, does seem to be better tolerated than Tecartus in particular. Only 2.5% of patients experienced grade 3 or higher CRS, 7% of patients experienced grade 3 or higher ICANS, and I would say that's been pretty on par with what we've seen in clinical practice since obe-cel's approval as well.
And I think something also very unique within the FELIX trial is some of these patients had more than 75% blasts undergoing CAR. So historically, we've done Tecartus patients and they've had very severe ICANS and neurotoxicity just because they did have a very high tumor burden. And so what's really unique about obe-cel is the majority of ICANS that patients did have were for those patients that did have the greater than 75% blast. I know one of the biggest things is kind of like what is the cutoff to proceed to obe-cel, especially if the blasts are greater than 75%. I think this is something our providers kind of talk about and potentially doing some additional bridging strategies or trying to just kind of do another line of therapy before proceeding to CAR, just because the outcomes weren't as good in those patients who had more than 75% blasts. But 75% is a pretty big number. So, I think this is definitely a valuable product specifically for those patients that have very high disease burden.
Rebecca, you touched on a good point. We've definitely had those conversations here at Duke as well for patients who have blasts greater than 75%, kind of their pre-obe-cel marrow. And we've done exactly the same. We've tended to lean more towards additional bridging therapy. I think there's some pretty good evidence out there for inotuzumab as a bridging therapy to CAR T in this space. And so we've tended to lean more towards like a mini CVD inotuzumab as a bridging therapy, as our kind of go-to bridging therapy prior to CAR T in this space, and it seems to have worked fairly well. But as you mentioned, pre obe-cel bone marrow blast percentage is definitely tied in the FELIX study to worse event-free survival and overall survival as well. So that's kind of been the driving factor for us to lean more towards additional bridging therapy before obe-cel.
And we do the same here at MSK. And I do want to specify, because I know in the Felix trial, numerically it said that patients that received prior inotuzumab had poorer responses, but this does not include the bridging therapy that Katie and Rebecca are talking about. So it is a discussion, and I think knowing that patients going in with lower burden of disease prior to obe-cel infusion, yeah, discussion is warranted about bridging therapy and incorporating inotuzumab. I think it's a good idea, and we see those longer-term survival outcomes for those patients. And I know there is a recent 3-year follow-up with obe-cel as well. It's encouraging that approximately 38% of patients, based on what was reported at the 3-year follow-up, that responses were maintained without any consolidative transplant or any other treatment. So going back to what Rebecca said earlier, this could be a definitive treatment for ALL.
Thank you. And given that obe-cel has a slightly different administration schedule, as discussed earlier, with two infusions, and the dose of each of these infusions is based on the initial tumor burden going into the obe-cel therapy, are there any differences in the safety profile in regards to both CRS or neurotoxicity? Toxicity with obe-cel when compared to the alternative CAR T therapies in this space?
I think the approach to using tumor burden is pretty novel. I'm hoping that other trials do the same. I think mostly the CAR construct may have led to more improved safety profiles with obe-cel as compared to Bruxocel, but definitely giving that lower dose up front, theoretically, it may see lower rates of CRS or ICANS. Based on the FELIX trial, we do know those with higher burdens do have higher rates of CRS and ICANS. And that's something that we take into account when those patients are typically admitted. And as Katie alluded to earlier, obe-cel rates in terms of grade 3 and up CRS rates was 2%. And if you compare that to the ZUMER-3 trial, CRS rates that were grade 3 or higher is 24%, so significantly higher rates of CRS with Bruxocel as opposed to obe-cel. With ICANS specifically, obe-cel ICANS rates grade 3 or higher is at 7%. With ZUMER-3 with Bruxocel, that grade 3 or higher ICANS is 25%. Again, very significant differences there. And Katie, I don't know if you have anything else to add to that as well.
No, I totally agree with both of you that, in addition to the novel CAR construct and its different single chain variable fragment, I think that lends itself to a better toxicity profile, as does the kind of blast percentage based dosing schema and the split dosing. I will say, from a split dosing standpoint, it has made things a little bit more of an operational challenge for us. I'm not sure if that's something that you guys have experienced as well. With the requirement to have a bone marrow biopsy resulting within 7 days prior to starting lymphodepletion. I don't know about y'all, our pathology department seems to be quite busy these days. And so we have gotten to the first day of lymphodepletion and not had results yet. And that also makes us a little nervous and makes things a little scary, right? And so I think from an operational standpoint, it's made it a little bit tricky. But I'd be interested in hearing y'all's experience.
Yeah, when this first came out, this was definitely something that was discussed in terms of the bone marrow biopsy results. I will say, fortunately, this has not yet been an issue at our site, MedMSK. We've been able to get those results. Something happens in the background, someone's talking to pathology maybe, but we were able to get those bone marrow biopsy results and scheduling obe-cel infusion as planned with no logistic issues as of yet, but maybe we'll reach out to you when that happens.
I think similar to kind of where like in between Jacqueline and Katie. So it does become kind of a logistical challenge. However, we definitely are on a first name basis with our pathologist, and I'm definitely, asking, hey, can we get like a preliminary, just I just need to know, is it more than 20% or less than 20, just to kind of get an idea of what's going on. But I think, at this point in time, the volume, and you guys can also kind of comment on that, is not as robust as, some of our myeloma CARs or lymphoma CARs. So I think at this point in time, the volume is not to the extent of some of our other CAR products. So we're able to kind of manage it in a controlled fashion. But I am curious to see what will happen if we continue to kind of expand our patient population to receive this product. One question I did have with you all is kind of that second infusion is around 9 days, plus or minus 2 days. So our group is kind of talking about maybe potentially is there a role to be able to administer that second cell dose a little bit earlier than a week out, just to kind of limit the time that the patient may need to be inpatient, since the tolerability profile is so unique and very well tolerated.
Yeah, that's been a discussion here as well. We've actually used that plus or minus 2 day window to our advantage. So for someone with very low or minimal residual disease, we may push that window to even 8 days to see if we could get them out early, earlier, discharged earlier, just as you mentioned, or even some logistical issues with the weekends. At MSK, we don't do cell, we don't administer, typically administer cell infusions on the weekends. So that plus or minus 2 day window, we're able to plan it to either be given on a Friday or given on a Monday. Those are some of the things at least we've been doing with that plus or minus 2 day window. We haven't gone outside that window, I will say. And we'd like to know if you guys have.
We have not. We've stuck to the package labeling so far and administered both. We've done two obe-cel so far, both on day 10. I will say I don't know that either patient that we've done so far would have been a great candidate for earlier second infusion. They both had extramedullary disease, and so we were treating them kind of on that high disease burden protocol. But I definitely could see our group being open to earlier administration for someone with low disease burden in the future.
Yeah, that we have not done it yet, but that is definitely, as Katie mentioned, kind of a consideration, especially for those low disease burden. Is there a window kind of ability to kind of shrink that time frame if they don't have any toxicities? I think something that we didn't touch on that are other kind of considerations beyond just CRS and neurotoxicity is some of our kind of more severe toxicities like immune effector cell or ICHS. So for like hemophagocytosis, the obe-cel rates were like 2% in comparison to tisa-cel, which was around 6%, and brexa-cel around 4%. So I think that's also kind of a valuable thing for like critically ill patients that need to be hospitalized for complications. The rate of that is extremely low. So again, kind of allowing it to be of a potential outpatient administration only. And then kind of long-term wise, our hematotox too for this product is very low in comparison to our other CAR products too. So even just long-term supportive care, transfusions and G-CSF and those type of things, we really have not needed for these patients. They do fairly well without having significant hematotoxicity post obe-cel.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up, Rebecca, because we've actually had the opposite experience. Both of our patients post obe-cel, we have one that's 3 months out and one that's 2 months out, and both have had pretty severe hematologic toxicity, more so than what we've seen historically with some of our other CAR T products in other spaces. Both have needed long-term G-CSF and transfusion support, and we actually just gave a CD34 boost to our first obe-cel patient this week. So that's definitely something that we're keeping a very close eye on. Again, I'm not sure if it's being driven just by patient selection, or maybe we're just having bad luck these first two, but it is something that we're keeping a close eye on here because it does seem to have been a little worse than maybe what the trials suggested, at least in our first two.
Yeah, we've only had a handful of obe-cel patients here, and I can recall one that had longer long-term or persistent cytopenias as well. So continued growth factor support, transfusions, which is it's not great for quality of life for that patient, unfortunately. I mean, they still had a response, they still responded. But unfortunately, still require frequent transfusions.
I think one of the unique things that I'm waiting on is I know you guys may or may not use it in practice, but the integration of the CAR hematotox score, a lot of times we've integrated that with our other CAR products, but with the recent publication of the ALL hematotox score, are you guys using that at all to kind of drive interventions or kind of recognizing those patients who are at higher risk for hematotox post-CAR, regardless of product?
It's definitely been something we've talked about, but haven't done a great job actually implementing or acting on. So it's definitely something that we need to have, ongoing discussions and see how we can better implement to change outcomes for our patients here at Duke.
Yeah, it's something that's discussed as well. And even the timing of, I mean, not just the G-CSF support, but whether romiplostim comes into play and the timing of that for our patients. Is that something that you guys have been using over there? And when the appropriate timing would be? I think maybe that's still something of the unknown.
Yeah, so right now we have not been in integrating in all of our patients. It's definitely been something that we're considering because I know at the time of, clearance for lymphodepletion, it's kind of already too late to kind of do any like upfront management or, increase bridging therapy for a patient. I know in the myeloma space, they're looking at kind of utilizing this carhematotox at the time of apheresis. So you really have that time to actually proactively do interventions that would kind of set them up for success. I think, one of the difficulties when we talk about it is that with the ALL hematotox score, they substituted out the ferritin for bone marrow blasts. And a lot of our obe-cel patients would already get 2 points because they have more than 25% blasts. So I think, from a scoring system, this was, it looked at from like a Brexacel and Tisacel kind of population, but not necessarily obe-cel. So that was kind of another discussion on, how do we integrate this specifically for obe-cel, knowing that, a large portion of patients are actually going to have two points right off the bat. And then for those patients that are considered high risk, it's anyone who has 4 points or more. So, if their ANC is low or their platelets are low or their hemoglobin's low, it's very likely that they'll already be considered high risk off the bat just from their blast count. So I think it's something really that I'm looking forward in the future to kind of see, is there a way to kind of tweak this algorithm to best fit some of these more risk adapted products where we're actually doing CAR T on very high tumor burden patients beyond the historical patients that we treated with Tisacel and Brexacel.
And as we wrap up, I would like to take a minute just to thank Katie, Becca, and Jackie for a very engaging discussion and sharing your expertise, and also offer you a chance to share any last-minute clinical pearls or key takeaways for our audience.
Thank you so much, Tatiana. I think from the pharmacy perspective, early intervention with anti-cytokine therapy has really transformed the care of our ALL patients. And I think despite very low rates of CRS and ICANS with obe-cel, of course, in the real-world population, these patients otherwise may not have met criteria. So I think it's very important that, to really kind of consider early interventions for these patients to avoid those grade three or higher toxicities.
I want to echo what Becca said as well in terms of early intervention with that anti-cytokine therapy. But other things to note as well is the cytopenias seen with this product. And we didn't touch up on this, but nausea and vomiting associated with lymphodepletion chemotherapy, because we are avoiding steroids, which is a pretty big antiemetic pre-med. So keeping a note of that post LDC and managing that and educating patients.
Absolutely echo what everyone else has said. I think huge role for the pharmacist when it comes to monitoring and intervening early on CRS and ICANS. But I think, it'll be interesting to see as we get more experience with obe-cel, what other toxicity profiles emerge. I think we're learning a lot about our other CAR T products and other spaces and some of the unique and newer toxicities associated with those products. So it'll be interesting to see as we get more experience with obe-cel, what comes in the future. I think it's a really exciting time in this space, not only with obe-cel, but I know there's other trials out there looking at dual CD19, CD22 targeted CAR products and other things. So really exciting time in the ALL space, I think.
Yes, very exciting to have some new and exciting treatment options. And thank you all again for sharing your expertise today.
Thanks for tuning in to today's episode, where we covered current challenges in ALL, the growing role of CAR T cell therapy, and what pharmacists should know about obe-cel. As cellular therapies continue to evolve, pharmacists will remain essential in translating trial data into safe, effective care at the bedside and beyond. We'll see you next time with more conversations at the intersection of oncology and pharmacy practice.